The Tom Woods Show, episode 2291.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, I don't know about you, but I am running into a lot of progressives saying, look, police, fire, schools, these are all great examples of socialism. Well, let's focus on that school example. I've got a free ebook called Education Without the State that makes a pretty darn good case for a stateless approach to education. Pick it up at nostateeducation.com. Hey folks, Tom Woods here. Finally, at long last, we got our friend Michael Malice here on the line, host of You're Welcome, author of challenging books, celebrity ghostwriter, successful troll. I don't know what that means, but he is a absolutely indispensable part of Twitter. If you're not following Michael Malice on Twitter, then you probably don't understand what the fuss is about Twitter. So follow him at Michael Malice. But Michael, of course, is the author most recently of a book that he slightly, occasionally, every once in a while, slightly hinted that he was working on, called The White Pill, A Tale of Good and Evil. So Michael, we're going to dig into this baby.
When I finished the book, I sent it to three people.
Oh, no.
You were one of them.
Yes.
So very glad 3.5 months later, after Dinesh D'Souza read it and interviewed me, you finally got around to doing so.
Well, yes, I have. And I have a lot of excuses.
It's not like I was the best man at your wedding or anything.
No, that is true. By the way, I noticed in at least one of Dinesh's books, he cites me. He also reads me. He likes us both, it turns out.
Yeah, okay, well, that's great. Dinesh D'Souza gets a bad rap in many ways. I extremely enjoyed the interview I had with him, and I thought it was really bright, and I was fearing it was going to be like a Hannity thing, being like, oh, you're talking about the Soviet Union. Isn't that basically Biden? And there was none of that.
Yeah, good, good, good. Yeah, I think he is on another level. I read Illiberal Education all those years ago. He was a student at Dartmouth. He's a smart guy.
Yeah.
So I agree with you on that. All right. I actually want to start off by reading a passage from page 14. And this is actually Ayn Rand speaking. And she's speaking to a congressman and trying to see if there's any way to get this congressman to be able to fathom what she's talking about. And she's not confident that it can be done. She says, and look.
Hold on. Before you go on, what you have identified is, for me, what codified the theme of the book. So you've exactly identified it correctly.
It was worth the 3.5 months, wasn't it?
No.
You bastard. All right, here we go. She says, look, it is very hard to explain. It is almost impossible to convey to a free people what it is like to live in a totalitarian dictatorship. I can tell you a lot of details. I can never completely convince you because you are free. It is, in a way, good that you can't even conceive of what it is like. Certainly, they have friends and mothers-in-law. This is a reference to one of the questions she was asked. They try to live a human life, but you understand it is totally inhuman. Try to imagine what it is like if you are in constant terror from morning until night, and at night you are waiting for the doorbell to ring, where you are afraid of anything and everybody, living in a country where human life is nothing, less than nothing, and you know it. You don't know who or when is going to do what to you because you may have friends who spy on you, where there is no law and any rights of any kind. And this passage actually calls to mind something you say a little bit later in the book, recounting a Russian joke about what it was like in the 1930s under Stalin when people would come to the door. The joke referred to the relief people feel when somebody would knock on their door in the middle of the night just to say that the house was on fire.
Yeah. Every time I hear that passage, and I've heard it now many, many times, I still get chills because having been born there, right? And obviously when I was born, it was a lot better than when Rand was talking about. But to me, it feels like those people who bought tickets on 9/11 and just like missed the flight and they still have that ticket. And you look at that ticket and you're like, holy crap. So the fact that like this could have been my life is just very unnerving.
I want to read one more passage, because I think these two in tandem say just so much. She's talking here about the significance to somebody living in a totalitarian regime, but specifically Soviet Russia, of the word abroad And she says, the meaning of that word for a Soviet citizen is incommunicable to anyone who has not lived in that country. If you project what you would feel for a combination of Atlantis, the promised land, and the most glorious civilization on another planet, as imagined by a most benevolent kind of science fiction, you will have a pale approximation. Abroad to a Soviet Russian is as distant, shining, and unattainable as these. Yet to any Russian who lifts his head for a moment from the Soviet muck, the concept abroad is a psychological necessity, a lifeline, and soul preserver. Now, Michael, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I have a feeling that especially given that you, in your dedication, thank your parents who got you out so that you didn't have to grow up in this environment. But I have a feeling that sometimes when, let's say, conservatives or boomers or whatever complain about this or that or the other problem, you're not saying you can't complain just because you're not living in Soviet Russia, but that they can't even begin. You have a society that at least works. You have a society that functions, and you have absolutely no idea what it's like to live in a completely alien civilization run by an alien regime that basically effaces your identity, the value of your life. And so I think my instinct is that sometimes when you hear libertarians say, well, you know, Ronald Reagan wasn't very good on spending. Okay, I'll grant you that. But there's a larger story at play here. Do you think that's roughly correct?
Well, there's two points. You forgot the other half of the dedication, which is for my parents who got me out and on behalf of all the children who never did.
Yeah.
The closest analogy we have to the era I'm talking about is North Korea in contemporary times. As you know, and everyone listening to this probably knows, I know several North Korean refugees. And one of the things I always talk to them about, or often talk to them about, is survivor guilt, that they're the ones who escaped and like people didn't who they grew up with, and how that really does a number on them. And how do you be like the person who survives a plane crash? You know what I mean?
And yeah, why me and not them? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's something that you're never going to be able to kind of wrap your head around. I'll disagree. Well, I'll go back to the first half of Rand's quote where she's like, look, you can't even imagine what it's like. When Castro died, and I was had the one of the great privileges of my life was being able to tell a Cuban friend of mine that Castro's dead, made me feel so great that I got to be the one to tell him. And a lot of people were saying, you know, talking all the good things about Cuba, and a lot of others were flipping out. My point was, I think it's good that there are some people who have no idea how bad things can get, that they've been so privileged and coddled. You know what I mean? Like, I think being an uncle now, and you're obviously a dad, there's a part of us that likes the idea that people can be raised in complete innocence and just, you know, like you have a dog and these dogs are so friendly, they can't even imagine a world where anyone harms them. Like, I like that kind of aspect. And I'm not too hard on them about Reagan or the boomers. The one I'm hardest about is, and this is the example I always brought up, was when Mike Bloomberg was mayor of New York City and he was eliminating like big gulps at 7-Eleven because he wanted to cut down on sugar and obesity. And Mike Huckabee, who had been governor of Arkansas at the time, was saying, oh, this is just like North Korea. And I'm like, if you think the biggest problem in North Korea is the size of their soda cups at the 24/7 convenience store, you are so removed from any kind of decency or reality. I don't even know where to start. So I'm not as harsh as them as you would think, because I like that people have the space to be soft. And I think it's a good thing that people can be kind of naive and oblivious, because that means the system is working, that they are kind of inculcated against harm.
I'd like to take our time a little bit going through this because there's so much to talk about in it. So I do want to say a little something about Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, who both feature in your previous book, The Anarchist Handbook. And in particular, I want to talk about them because the phenomenon of people outside of Soviet Russia going to visit there after the Bolshevik Revolution is an interesting one in its own right. And they don't all come to the conclusions that Goldman and Berkman do. But I'd like to start there. So the two of them are well-known anarchists and deeply and profoundly committed to that cause. And although they understand that Marxism is not quite the same thing, nevertheless, Emma Goldman said that she had an expectation that it would on net be a benefit for mankind and that over time, maybe the state does wither away. So she looked to this so-called experiment with great hope. And then they actually went to see it for themselves. So can you pick it up there?
Well, sure. I mean, they didn't go voluntarily. They were deported.
Indeed. But there were some people who, well, I want to talk about the other intellectuals later.
Sure. But that's what's interesting. They were deported by J. Edgar Hoover and Woodrow Wilson. It's like, oh, you like it so much, go back to Russia.
Yeah.
And this was a country neither of them, that country that literally didn't exist before and that they had not been to in many years. The state stripped Emma Goldman's, she had a very brief marriage. They stripped him of his citizenship. And as a result, she lost her citizenship. And he had never had Alexander Berkman Ruhrig's citizenship. So this is very much their kind of chicanery to get rid of them. And there's a bunch of other radicals. It was called the Red Ark. And they said, you know, get the F out of town, go back to Russia. And they're like, fine, we will. And she admitted it was completely devastating for her, and understandably so. This had been her home for many years. And what I tried to do was to express things from their perspective, because they're like, all right, this is a new country. We're all under the socialist umbrella. We all agree that capitalism, what they call capitalism, is unworkable and exploitative and evil. It's like, all right, so this is our shot. Let's see if we can make it work. And this is, I think, very, very common with people in like tribal thinking. They kept trying to make it work and hand wave away this and hand wave away that. Oh, we have to compromise here. Well, Lenin doesn't mean it. Well, this is just because it's wartime. You're not going to argue that while we're fighting a civil war, you're going to have some restrictions and liberties. That just makes sense. And then at a certain point, it's just like, oh, okay, they're not messing around. Like, there's no possibility that there's going to be free speech, or they're going to care about the working class, or there's going to be any kind of respect for the individual or even basic human dignity. And Berkman said he literally kissed the ground when he landed there. And then they spend the rest of their lives, from my perspective, basically making restitution and being like, guys, this is a bigger nightmare than the worst of the czar by far. This is not what we're about as socialists and anarchists, which is the working class, the individual, taking care of people through mutual aid. And the disturbing part, which I think is very analogous to today, is after they left, people who had never stepped foot outside of England or the United States told them to their face, you don't know what you're talking about. And I was just on Dr. Drew's show yesterday, Dr. Drew Pinsky, who is not a Jill Biden doctor or like a Tom Woods doctor, but a real doctor. And
yeah,
during COVID, when he's asking all these questions, he had randos on Twitter telling him, you know what you're talking about. But it's like, but I am a doctor. I'm not someone reading Alex Jones and retweeting things. And the kind of arrogance of people who know better than you, despite never having left the confines of their home, is not a recent phenomenon with social media. This has been going on for over a century.
Oh, yeah. You've got in here, I don't remember what the occasion was, but recounting a speech that Emma Goldman gave.
In London. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And she was noticing that it was not being received as a speaker might want remarks to be received. And no doubt the vast bulk of the people in the room, obviously she knows much more about what she's talking about. Probably next to none of them had ever seen any of this for themselves. So here she is with a firsthand report, and they don't want to hear it because it's not the report they want.
Right. Like Red Emma, who is dedicated to bloody revolution, is being called a tool of the capitalists. And she can only sit there and be like, you know, my lover went to jail for 10 years, 12 years, whatever, 13, I remember who it was, for trying to assassinate Carnegie's right-hand man, Frick. And so it's like, how much of a red-blooded credential do you want?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so I want to go a little bit out of order in this because I want to stay on the theme of what...
Wait, can I just say one more thing?
Yeah.
Why that scene is so important is obviously the Soviet authorities did everything in their power to keep information about the conditions in the Soviet Union from being made known internationally other than things that would make them look good, right? That makes sense. Goldman and Berkman were talking about this in the 20s. So you can't claim that like, oh, we didn't know how bad it was. We only found out later after Khrushchev kind of liberalized. They knew from the start and they didn't give a damn about what was being done to these people.
Well, that calls to mind, this is much, much later, but in the early 1990s, the now deceased historian Eugene Genovese wrote an essay
yes,
in a left-wing journal called Dissent called The Question. And he was asking
there,
exactly
yeah,
what you're saying. What did you know and when did you know it? And these are questions that much of the intelligentsia would prefer not to answer.
Right. And no, his conclusion was, we all knew and we knew from the beginning.
Yes. And I was one of you, so don't try to tell me that I'm snowing you people. I know you knew because I was there.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that because immediately after the
Did Russian, I not include that in the book? Because that was crucial. I hope I included that.
Well, now it's all kind of merged in my head.
Okay, I don't remember. Okay.
What I knew already and what I learned from your book. Yeah. And by the way, I learned a lot from this book. There were a lot of interesting details I hadn't known. Russian humor I hadn't been aware of, stuff like
that. Oh, really?
Okay. Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I'll go back and look through all my markings, but I have definitely marked this because I will refer to this in some of my own, with credit, I'll refer to this in the odd speech here and there because you found some good stuff. In a way, the writing reminds me a bit, I mean this as a high compliment, it reminds me a bit of Paul Johnson.
Oh, wow. I just finished his book this week. That's amazing.
Okay. But you see what I mean? Every page, there's something interesting and new leaping off it. It's not a drag or it's not just fluff. And as I say, quotations that are so apt and perfect and you've never heard before and it's just devastating. But I want to talk about people who went and looked at it or cheerleaded for it from afar because this is a very interesting intellectual phenomenon. We have countless American intellectuals, but also people in the UK who really believed that a new world for mankind was opening up. And for some reason, they were never really fully discredited for having thought this.
Right.
But think it, they did.
Well, it's not just that they thought it. It's that they told you that you're stupid for not thinking it.
Yeah, you're stupid for not thinking it.
But
that's
I
right.
mean, you laugh, but that's what's just, it'd be one thing if we had an honest, vigorous public debate and being like, all right, here's the screwed up things they're doing. Here are the good things they're doing. Here's the screwed up things they're doing in the West. Here's the good things they're doing in the West. Let's learn from them, you know, or whatever. That wasn't it. They're right and you're wrong and you're stupid and backwards. And all this bad stuff you're believing is just you've been the product of capitalist propaganda. So that to me is what makes it an obscenity.
Now, it seems to me that by the time we get to, let's say, the 1960s,
oh, yeah.
The people who are actively cheering for the Soviet Union by that point are really just the hard left. And I think partly because of Khrushchev's speech, which, yes, it's delivered in secret, but people figured out he was going in a different direction. And people started to realize, as if there wasn't enough evidence about it already, what Stalin had been up to, it becomes a little bit harder to keep on defending it. There were still plenty of intellectuals who did, but they were really the true believers. But yet by the 1960s, nevertheless, I can tell you that in the Catholic world, even though up through 1958, under Pope Pius XII, the condemnations of communism were regular and severe. But then in the 1960s, from 62 to 65, they held the Second Vatican Council. 16 documents came out of that council, and one of them, Gaudium et Spes, is on the place of the church in the modern world. And not one word about communism is mentioned, which has a little something to do with the church's relationship with the modern world. Nothing. Just everybody tiptoeing around it. So what I credit Reagan for is coming along and just saying, hello, everybody. Why can we not just be honest and speak openly and frankly about this force that we're facing?
I'm sorry, maybe this is my Karen hat talking. I don't understand how you can laugh about this. Because when you're talking about a nation where you are going to be tortured and killed for your faith, any faith, let's suppose they're just doing this to Muslims, right?
Yeah.
You would think, I would have thought, I didn't know what you just had just told me. You would think that the Catholic Church, there's no incentive for them to bite their tongue. It's not like
right.
they're in good with the Russians and they're corrupt, so they're cutting a deal that they get to kind of have some masses and in exchange they keep their mouth shut. Like, I can wrap my head around that. I wouldn't necessarily agree, but I don't understand the intricacies of the relationship between, at that point, the Vatican and the USSR. But to have it be absolutely a felony and the death penalty or going to Siberia, where priests were tortured into removing their collar and denouncing God from the pulpit, and for them to bite their tongue, I don't think that's funny at all. I find that extremely disturbing.
The thing is, I've been writing about and dealing with these people within the church for a long time. And it's like the more you dig, the more you don't want to dig anymore, the more you find out about these people. So there are all kinds of theories as to why
What's the point of being a priest at all in that case?
I think the rank and file were generally good.
Okay, yeah.
As is usual with almost every institution, you know, the rank and file are okay. The leadership are just horrendous. But unfortunately, the leadership is everything in the Catholic Church. That's just given the way it's structured. Anyway, that's a side point.
Well, it's not a side. There's just one more point. It's not just Reagan. It's Pope John Paul II was absolutely crucial when we're fast forwarding to the book in the late 70s, when he was the first Polish pope ever, I believe, the first non-Italian pope in centuries. And he's told not to come to Poland, which is a very heavily Catholic country then and now. And he was told, oh, pretend that you're sick, by Brezhnev. And he's like, I'm not sick. And he basically told Brezhnev to go F himself. And he got in a plane to Poland. And it was just this incredible series of events where he's holding these public masses and hundreds of thousands of people literally are turning out in defiance of what would be preferred by the authorities and looking around each other and realizing that we've got the numbers.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if that's literally miraculous because it's easily explainable by natural phenomenon, but it's as close to divine as you're going to find here on earth, in my view.
Yes, I agree. I agree. Those masses were very significant for that exact reason. I mean, I'm sure in their heart of hearts, they knew that the communist bureaucracy was a numerical minority, but the sheer vastness of those crowds, and then also John Paul suggesting in one of his sermons that the divisions in Europe that were in effect codified at Yalta were not necessarily permanent, and that the world could be different someday. And that's what these people needed at that time.
Yeah.
Anyway, I want to go back. Let's go back. You talk in here about something I remember hearing about when I was studying 20th century Russia in college. Our professor referred to the good Lenin, bad Stalin myth. And one thing I can say, there are a lot of bad things you can say about Harvard, but they had a good Russian studies department, and not one of them bought into the good Lenin, bad Stalin myth. But I understand why people want to think that. You know, Lenin is the heroic revolutionary, and then Stalin is the terrible brute who perverted everything Lenin did. So what's the real truth of the matter?
Well, I think what you're speaking to has also been heavily promoted by Trotskyites, right? Because after Trotsky, who was Lenin's kind of sidekick, gets power stripped from him and deported from the Soviet Union entirely and is made the villain for anything that goes bad in the Soviet Union, of course, tying in kind of anti-Semitic tropes from the Soviet Union. And he was parodied, or whatever, I don't know if parody is the word, as Emmanuel Goldstein in 1984 by Orwell. If you're a Trotskyite, you still have faith that this is going to work out. That's where you kind of diverge from history. You got to be like, all right, it was good before. And then, you know, it kind of went in a bad direction. But Trotsky's book was called The Revolution Betrayed. And the Trotskyites became the neocons in America. And they were very influential here in the West. Max Eastman, I believe, was a Trotskyite. And James Burnham, who, in my view, is like the most important conservative thinker in the 20th century in many ways, was friends with Trotsky. But what this book shows, as you said, you know, if they've got a smart Russian studies department, which I'm sure they do, it's almost impossible to make the case that Lenin is good and Stalin's bad, and that Stalin invented things that Lenin hadn't put in place. Now, he certainly escalated them, and he certainly solidified power within his person more than Lenin did. But the fact that all the things that we hate about Stalin didn't have enormous antecedent origins, sorry, English is my second language, in Lenin, the fact that Lenin wasn't bloodthirsty beyond belief and just kind of had this orgiastic visions of blood upon blood upon blood and saving the people, which is a very Marxist point of view, you know, this Marxist kind of end of times, we're going to have this bloody revolution and then we're going to have nirvana. It's almost impossible to make that case with a straight face, other than kind of perverting history, that Lenin was good and Stalin was bad, or that Lenin and Stalin were completely different in their tactics and approaches.
Well, apparently, Lenin seemed to be suggesting that, as you said at the beginning, once normal conditions are restored and we don't have a civil war going on and this and that, well, then, of course, we can indulge some of your bourgeois concerns here. But right now, we have to be ruthless. And then, as you say, Emma Goldman began to realize that, no, they're institutionalizing the ruthlessness. It's not just an emergency measure, let's say, that this is exactly the character of the regime.
Yeah, we all need the Patriot Act until we resolve the problem with Al-Qaeda, and then everything's going to go back to normal. It's the exact parallel, although obviously much, much worse.
And Lenin, by the way, now, most study of religion in the Soviet Union, of course, deals with the Orthodox Church, because Catholicism in Russia is very, very, I mean, there are very few people who are Catholics as compared to Orthodox, but I've studied that because I study oddball things. And they were being told that they had to hand over their sacred vessels so the regime could melt them down and sell them for food. And so the Vatican, which at that time was actually not super wealthy, the Pope said, I will mail you a check for the monetary amount of all those vessels but ask you not to melt them down. I'll send you the money, the monetary equivalent. And Lenin never even responded because the point wasn't even so much the money as it was the humiliation.
Well, as disturbing as writing this book has been, I don't know what the word is, but the fact that there's even more levels of depravity is something that's not sitting well with me right now, I can tell you.
Yeah. Horrible. So, but it is true, though, that what some people want to say about Lenin to maybe rehabilitate him to some degree is that he warned people about Stalin, that he was a brute and that he would do this, that, and the other thing. What do we think about that? I mean, on the other hand, he created a system in which a Stalin could come to power.
Well, I mean, just because Lenin did things differently than Stalin doesn't mean one's good and one's bad, right? It could be one's bad and one's worse. If you had to make me choose between the two, I would choose Lenin. First of all, he died much younger, I mean, faster. But one of the things that Lenin did that Stalin didn't is Lenin was a bit more of a pragmatist, right? So there were situations where he pulled back on the power of the state. And from his perspective, they always talked about how socialism is scientific, but a lot of it was kind of like figuring out as he went along. It's like, all right, this worked, this didn't. Let me kind of tinker with these things because we're basically recreating human nature from the beginning. Whereas with Stalin, he would just always double down. And even at the cost of literally millions of lives, he was just always doubling down. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, Stalin did consolidate power heavily after Lenin. Lenin was not this kind of autocrat and this kind of personality cult that Stalin later developed. He was much more committed to this idea of like, I'm going to live frugally and try to have everyone be as equally as possible, including the leader. But frankly, I don't care. If you're running a successful society and you're getting cuts on the side to live in a palace, I don't begrudge the leader that. And I think few people would either if everyone is thriving and the leader has a really nice house.
Let me ask you a thing about Stalin. Do you have the sense that even though I know that when he was younger, he did write ideological tracts, but do you think, let's say, as he's carrying out the purges and the Ukrainian terror famine in the 1930s, do you think he is an ideologue or do you think the ideology is a convenient cover for his raw exercise of power?
I think it's pretty largely agreed that he is not at all an ideologue, that he was just power for the sake of power. I don't think anyone other than people who were under his thumb at the time regard him as having any great contributions to communist or Marxist thought other than his idea of having communism in one country as opposed to it being an internationalist workers' revolution in the Trotsky and Lenin vein. And even today, when people look back, they talk about Marxism-Leninism, right, by people who are like these kind of mothball-ridden commies. So I think it's very hard to make the case that he, unlike, say, Hitler or Mao, was someone who was just really invested in this ideology and wanted to make it work. That does not seem accurate to me at all.
Well, let's pause here because I want to talk about Stalin a bit next time. As I say, of course, we have quite a few American intellectuals, and we'll talk about this, who either would make excuses for what Stalin was doing or would try to explain it away or say, well, after all, those people did get trials and they were duly found guilty. I want to get to the bottom of that. So we'll do that in the next episode. So the book, of course, is The White Pill, A Tale of Good and Evil. Linking to it at tomwoods.com/2291. Michael, we'll take this up tomorrow. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
All right, folks, as if that material weren't serious enough, we're going to close this episode on quite a serious note, but I suppose also a hopeful one. I suppose many of you know that I am the father of five daughters. So what I'm about to tell you holds a special significance for me, but I hope it will hold special significance for all of you out there who are parents. I have a friend named Blake Brewer. He was recently featured on the Today Show in one of the very, very rare cases in which the mainstream finally got something right. Blake was 19 years old when he went on a Hawaiian vacation with his family. First day of the vacation, he went out snorkeling with his father. And he was so happy, there was nowhere else he'd rather be in the world at that moment than with his father snorkeling. But they drifted into what he later found out was called Witch's Brew, which is an area of especially treacherous waters. And his father began to call for help. And so Blake raced out to get hold of him and try his best to bring him to shore while keeping his head above water. He did get some help from some lifeguards who spotted them. and CPR was administered, but it was too late. His father literally died in his arms. I'll bet that's not the way you expected this story to go. And of course, it's not the way Blake expected his life to go. Everything changed at that moment. His future, everything changed. How am I going to live without my father? And that day, as his family was processing what had just happened, his mother happened to be going through his father's briefcase, and she came across a letter that he had written to Blake and his other two children, and he'd been working on it for 2 or 3 months, and he was planning to give it to them during the trip. And he had no idea the significance that letter would have, that letter that reminded them of his love for them and gave them advice and guidance. That letter meant everything to Blake. So years later, Blake decided, as a father himself, he would sit down and write a letter just like that for his own children. But as he sat down to do it, he realized, wow, this is easier said than done. I'm supposed to write this big, profound thing, and I'm not really a profound guy. I don't really know what to do. But he worked at it, worked at it, worked at it. And he reached a point where he realized that he had kind of cracked a code in a way. He'd kind of figured out exactly how to say things we want to say, but we don't exactly know how to say. And so he's calling this letter the Legacy Letter. And he launched something called the Legacy Letter Challenge, where he is on a mission to get 1 million moms and dads to write their legacy letter for their children. Well, I'm going to write this letter myself for my children. And Blake is doing a special presentation for my people on how to write this letter. And so if you decide to hop on and write your own letter, then in a special session I will schedule down the road when my letter is ready, I will read you my letter, because maybe it will help give you ideas for your own letter. Now, I know we're all busy, but for heaven's sake, some things you just have to make time for. And I'm a pretty busy guy, and I'm kind of a work hard, play hard kind of guy, but I'm going to carve out the time to write my own legacy letter. So I hope you'll join us on this session with Blake himself. You'll find it at tomwoods.com/legacy-letter. He's already been doing this with a lot of people, and the reviews, they're just rave reviews, what the experience has been like writing that letter. So do be there with me. This is happening March 8th, 2023. So tomwoods.com/legacy-letter is the link, and I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.